KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Slavoj Žižek was named by Foreign Policy as one of the world's top 100 intellectuals, and the Village Voice called him a one-person culture mulcher. We'll talk with him about violence, film, his heroes, Hegel and Lacan, communism, and why the person he most admires is Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He joins us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Slovenian-born political philosopher and culture critic Slavoj Žižek has been called, among other things, the Elvis Presley of philosophy and one of the world's most prominent and provocative philosophers and cultural theorists. The author of 30 books, he is senior researcher at the Institute of Sociology at the University of Ljubljana in Slovenia, and he's been visiting professor at Columbia, Princeton, and the New School. The subject of a recent documentary film called Žižek. He has just recently been the director at this year's Telluride Film Festivals. And in fact, it was Tom Letty who called Slavoj Žižek to my attention and said he's going to be in town. He'll be at City Arts and Lectures tomorrow evening. And we have him by phone here. He's a man who says he likes to wear a mask, would like to wear a mask of himself so people would think he was someone else trying to be him. And it's good to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. Here am I. But you know that reference about mask to be a mask of myself
yes.
is basically a variation of my favorite Marx Brothers quote, which is, you know, this man looks as an idiot, acts as an idiot, but this shouldn't deceive you. This man is an idiot. It's the same logic.
Yeah, well, I love your sense of humor, and there's much to talk about with you. I should mention to listeners that this is a man who is known for his study of figures like Lacan and Hegel and Marx, but also who does a lot of political analysis and brings in a great deal of popular culture and talks about film. Let's talk about film first before we get into more controversial things. And I know you've given me free license to interrupt you because you love to talk and feel that sometimes you go on a little bit.
Long story short, I need a domina, you know, somebody.
You need a dominator, yes?
Okay, dominator. Okay.
Yeah.
If no domina, you're a second best. Okay.
Well, let me go to your what you said about cinema, first of all, because I know you're going to be doing a symposium on Hitchcock's Vertigo at Stanford. Nice plug for that. But you call cinema the ultimate pervert's art because it doesn't give you what you desire. It tells you what to desire.
Oh, my God. This is a wonderful question to begin with, because with here we even touch the big topic, violence, namely the basic lesson of psychoanalysis, which can be put very simply, is that the function of fantasies and so on, it's not that you don't get what you want, so you fantasize about it. How do you know what you want in the first place? We are not animals. Animals know what they want by their instinct. So the role of fantasies is, yes, in this sense, to tell us what to desire, to construct the coordinates of our desire, which is why I think, among other things, there are real work of art, but basically cinema is still the crucial art. It's not the explicit message of a film, but again, what you desire, what you fear, and so on. Our real life is structured with reference to cinema here.
And you talk about American film as being particularly, following a certain motif or archetype where violence is concerned. You talk about Travis, the character played by Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver, or you talk also about Mystic River. But tell us a bit about how you see American violence reflected in film, or what is peculiarly American violence.
First, I would say, if I may just make a small remark, I couldn't resist mentioning two films. When people tell me, but aren't you exaggerating cinema, ideology? Where do you see ideology? We live in a cynical post-ideological era. No. Let me take two big recent hits, if I may, very briefly. The Dark Knight, the last Batman movie, and Kung Fu Panda. I think they are both ideology at its purest. Why The Dark Knight? You remember towards the end, The basic message is, in order to sustain, maintain social stability, social ethics, we need a lie. The good guy has to sacrifice himself, assuming the crimes he didn't commit, in order to redeem in public memory the bad guy, but whose memory should remain that of a good guy. It's an old motive, incidentally, in American cinema, from John Ford's two classics, Fort Apache and The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. So it's very interesting that precisely at this political moment, the motive of the social necessity of a political lie is asserted. Okay, we can go on later. I don't want to lose time into Kung Fu Panda. But back to violence. What interests me, apropos Hollywood violence, is how often, for me, violence acts precisely as a, how to put it, passive reaction in order to confront the real problem. My favorite situation would be, I hope the listeners knew it, The Fugitive, the TV version with Harrison Ford. At the end, when Harrison Ford discloses the corruption of big medical companies, you would have expected some kind of a big public confrontation against big capital. No, what you get is a totally ridiculous fight between, fist fight, literally, between the hero and the small-time crook, not the big managers and so on and so on. So I claim that how often violence, this idea of final violent confrontation, is simply a negative of the fear to confront the truly bad guys, to put it in this way.
Let me follow this theme of violence with you, if I may, because...
Sorry?
I want to follow this theme of violence with you, because you write a good deal about it. In fact, I said that your most recent book is called Violence. But you talk about terrorism and Islamic inferiority complex with respect to violence, where some of the Islamic terrorism has been concerned. And then you talk about the violence in Paris with the fires and in Katrina. And it seems to me what you're talking about is different national patterns or different ethnic patterns with respect to violence. Is that not the case?
You can say this, but what interests me at a more... But, okay, first, when we talk about different national patterns, we should nonetheless not forget, when we talk about so-called, apropos so-called fundamentalist religious violence, that, I mean, let's not limit it all too easily to Arab Muslim fundamentalists. What about here in the States, your own violence? I read in an official report that FBI had at this point around 2 million people of American citizens under observation, suspected not of Islamic ties, but of your own Christian survivalist, however you call it, violence. So the deeper question to be asked is why this kind of a violence which is obviously somehow created, generated by the modern capitalist dynamics. Point two, the violence in Paris, you know, cars were burning and so on, interests me is that I think that its signals points towards a very sad political moment, a moment where the left, the progressives, cannot propose a feasible political alternative to the present system. They cannot even truly dream, propose a utopian alternative, as in 68. All that can be done is some kind of an empty gesture of protest. I followed closely the Paris car burning in the suburbs. What surprised me so much is that those guys were not even, as some critics assumed, some kind of Islamic fundamentalists. No, the first thing they burned were their own local mosques and Islamic cultural centers. It was a kind of an abstract no. Just destroy and be noted, like people should note us, without any positive program. In this sense, I like to, in my Hegelian way, unity of the opposites, to combine this violence, to see a link between this violence and its apparent opposite, which interests me very much, so-called flash mobs. You know, thousands of people gather at a certain place, just do something to interrupt the normal flow, like recently in Paris. 3,000 people gathered on Place de la Concorde and stood firmly as a statue for 1 minute. It's the same thing. It's an empty gesture, like we want a break, we want change. Nobody knows what the positive program is.
And recognition, really, is what you're saying.
Yeah. But what interests me here, and that's the tragedy, with all my admiration and so on for Barack Obama, isn't there a little bit of that in him? In what sense? I mean, I'm for Obama as a foreigner, as far as I can be. I admire him, but you know when he repeats all this formula, believe in change, audacity to hope. To hope what? To change what? The moment he gets from this high rhetorics to proposals, they turn out to be, sometimes, most of the time, interesting, but nonetheless, much more ordinary proposals and so on and so on. We have a problem here, I think. We have a problem here.
Well, you know, let me dovetail on what you just said about Obama, because we're talking, by the way, with Slavoj Žižek, and there's been some serious concern and criticism about you, as I'm sure you're well aware. Johan Hari, in The New Statesman said there's, you know, a lot of Marx and Lacan and Hegel, but what do you stand for? And what he argues, and I'm interested in hearing what you have to say about this, is that you stand essentially for a love of Lenin and Bolshevism and a kind of belief in violence with tyranny. I guess you're on record as saying that you love Mussolini and that you like tyranny to some extent. Perhaps you ought to at least give us a sense of what you really stand for here.
With pleasure. First, okay, maybe I have this problematic tendency to make bad taste, ironic remarks, and so on and so on. But I think it's one of the signs of the general decadence, regression of our times, how things which are obviously meant in an ironic way are then taken literally. So, to go back to your question, no, my position is here minimalist. Incidentally, yes, I wrote a book on Lenin. But far from simply praising Lenin, I did try, true in that book, to show where I see the authentic greatness of October Revolution. But then, in no ambiguous terms, I tried to show how Stalinism was not just an unfortunate outcome. You know, all the Trotskyite myths, like if only Lenin were to survive 1 year more and made a pact with Trotsky, Stalin would have been ousted, we would have a flowering socialist democracy or what. No, there was a necessity. It was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And the problem for me is neither to dismiss it as rotten from the beginning, nor from the right-wing point to say, from the left-wing point to say it was a good project just because of contingent reasons it failed. It was a genuine tragedy, an authentic attempt at liberation, not only failed, but created horrors which are arguably even worse than at least the majority of right-wing horrors. So I totally accept this. The story of Lenin is over. As I wrote in my piece, today we should repeat Lenin not in the sense of doing the same thing, but in the sense of starting from a zero point again.
Were you being ironic when you said you admire, there are things you admire about Stalin and things you admire about Mao Zedong?
Wait a minute. First, I don't think I ever used these words, admiring. Now, we should be here very precise. What is there to admire in Stalin? Of course, nothing. The thing that I think we should confront is, again, the strange nature of Stalinism. If anything, my position is that we do not even yet have the appropriate theoretical apparatus to genuinely understand Stalinism and its monstrosity. I think that the ordinary books, films, and so on about Stalinism are paradoxically, the more they are radically anti-communist, right-wing, paradoxically for me even too soft on Stalinism. For me, Stalinism is still a big enigma. We have general condemnations and so on. We all agree of that. But do we have a theory of how was something like that possible? Stalinism is for me a much more mysterious phenomenon than fascism. To put it in very simple terms, fascists were a bad guy who said, we will do some bad things, kill the Jews and so on. And look what a surprise, they really did it. Stalinism originated out of something which nonetheless was a genuine attempt at liberation. My God, you have to read first-hand reports of what really went on in the early years of October Revolution to see it. And nonetheless, it ended up as a total nightmare. And so, I think
Talking with Slavoj Žižek, I just want to mention again that you are the guest here this hour, and we're going to invite people to join us shortly. But you had mentioned that someone you do admire is Barack Obama. I read an interview with you in The Guardian where you said the person you admire most is Jean-Bernard Aristide. Why?
Because I read a couple of books on him. I even know people who know him. And I think he is, for me, the model of how you can, if you really try in all the despair, in a totally desperate situation, to do something at least for the people. What interests me with him is how, while, let's be clear here, while respecting all the formal democratic rules and so on, multi-party freedom of the press and so on and so on, he nonetheless combined, again, absolutely legitimate democratic regime with a kind of mobilization, grassroots mobilization of the people. What he tried to do in Haiti is, for me, an approximation of how what old Marxist classics called dictatorship of the proletariat would have been. And I think it was one of the great scandals of our era, how he was twice overthrown with the complicity of, it's not only United States, France, even Brazil's Lula, and so on and so on. I think he is the guy who tried to do something even in a totally hopeless situation, to bring a little bit more justice and so on and so on. Because you see what's the problem for me? Just a brief comment. For the same reason, I have also, with all my critique of Chavez, some sympathy, basic sympathy for Chavez. Why?
Chavez, the main character in Taxi Driver,
Okay, he moved from there. No, sorry, I meant Venezuela, Hugo.
You said Chavez. I thought you said Travis. Because
No. Hugo Chavez. Because the big problem today, I claim, is the growth, explosive growth of people who live, how should I call it, outside public space, in favelas, in slums, who, while they are formally citizens of a state, in a way are excluded from public civil life. And I think that whatever we say about Chavez, and there are many things to criticize, he was the only one, apart from Aristide, who truly tried to mobilize, politically awaken those excluded. Are we aware that if we, with all justified critique of Chavez, if we don't find a better way to do it, we will end up in a kind of a prolonged, permanent, low-level, maybe most of the time, civil war with events like Paris car burnings all the time and so on and so on. I think this is one of the crucial political questions today. But may I briefly just, so that I will not be accused of avoiding it, just very briefly, may I answer your basic question, which was, what then do I stand for?
Well, I want to be accurate here. Did you once say, for example, communism will win? Because we're talking about Hugo Chavez, who is seen by many in the West, and particularly in the United States, as a communist.
No, absolutely not. In what sense should he be a communist? I think he is, if you look at his effective political measures and so on, he is, I think, just another version of typical Latino American populism. No. Now to shock you. Okay, absolutely. I still consider myself a communist. Okay, it would take some time to explain, but my basic problem is this one. It's the Fukuyama problem. That is to say, we all like to make fun of Francis Fukuyama in the sense of that crazy guy who thought history is over. But I claim that practically all of us, left included, large majority of the left, we are, how should I put it as a verb, substantive, Fukuyamaists. We basically believe that capitalism and liberal democracy are maybe the best of the worst, but the best we can get. And even for the majority of the leftists, the most we can do is to try to make it a little bit better, more gay rights, more feminine, more tolerance, less hate, whatever you want. But it's within this scope. Nobody asks today the questions that were still asked 30, 40 years ago. Is capitalism inevitable? Is democracy the way we know it, the ultimate horizon? Now, I'm not saying it's clear what should replace these forums. All I'm saying is this.
You're saying we aren't in a post-ideological or post-political world, is what you're saying. Really.
Yeah, but this is what I meant, again, in a sense of this is our self-designation. We perceive ourselves as post-ideological, but we are I can maybe return to this later. We are more in ideology than ever. Okay, let me first answer maybe this question so that maybe it's even more amusing. You know, how do we relate today to ideologies? Of course, we are in post-ideological world in the sense of utter cynicism, in the sense of nobody even expects you to believe, but I think I quote it in, I forgot in which of my books, there are too many, as you hinted at, a wonderful anecdote about Niels Bohr, you know, the Copenhagen guy, quantum physics.
The physicist, yeah.
Yes, he had in his country house a horseshoe above the entrance to the house. I don't know how it is in the States. In Europe, this is the standard superstitious item. It's destined to prevent the evil spirits entering the house, no? And the story is that a friend scientist visited him and asked him, but wait a minute, you're a scientist. This is superstition. Why do you have this there? Do you believe in it? You know what answer Niels Bohr gave? He said, my God, I'm a scientist. Of course, I don't believe in it. Then, counter question, but why do you have it then? Niels Bohr said, I don't believe in it, but I have it there because I heard that it works even if you don't believe in it. That's how we are doing today. Nobody really believes in democracy, law, and so on. But we act as if we believe. I mean, this is why, let me make now a jump, you see how my crazy mind works, to Hollywood. There is the film, the other one that I mentioned. We are now back to Kung Fu Panda, which presents this today's status of ideology at its purest. On the one hand, the movie is cynical, makes fun of all sacred values of Kung Fu, of Buddhism, and so on. You know, the fundamental message being there is no secret ingredient, and so on. Everything is a fake, and so on. But the lesson is, nonetheless, but you must believe. You know everything is a fake, but act as if you believe you must believe. I think it's a deeply cynical film. It's the best rendering of the elementary formula of our situation today, where nobody believes, but everybody acts as if to believe, as if you believe.
We're talking with Slavoj Žižek, yeah. And he'll be at City Arts and lectures in San Francisco tomorrow evening. And he is, as foreign policy lists him, one of the top 100 intellectuals in the world, up there with Noam Chomsky and Richard Dawkins and Jared Diamond and people like Umberto Eco. I'm going to open our phone lines, and lots to talk about here. Certainly, he covers a great deal of territory, as you can hear, a lot of it having to do with movies and film and Hollywood and popular culture, but also the whole question of violence and how violence manifests itself under different ideologies, and certainly also he has been, in so many instances, encountering in his work or confronting in his work the whole question of ideology. And I'm going to invite those of you listening to join in this conversation. If you have something you'd like to contribute, by all means do. There's a phone line that is toll-free, and it's available to you whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. And that number is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls, and you can also, of course, send us an email, and our email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. The challenge of talking, I must say to you, Slavoj Žižek, is, of course, because your mind ranges around in so many different directions, and because, as you say, you cover so much different territory and are so expansive. But we're going to hear from our listeners next, and I know many of them are familiar with your work and also have responses to what they've heard so far. Again, I should mention that Mr. Žižek is particularly conversant and has been a scholar, written books about Lenin, about violence, but also particularly about Jacques Lacan, the psychoanalyst, French psychoanalyst, post-Freudian, and about Hegel and Marx. When we return, we'll hear what you have to say. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Slavoj Žižek, who has written many books and has written on many subjects, and in fact, has come to stand for a kind of assault on identity politics, as well as challenging the skepticism that one finds in the United States toward, in the academy particularly, toward things such as transcendent truth and Western enlightenment. And Mr. Žižek sees those as different forms of totalitarianism. He has expressed a certain admiration for different kinds of totalitarianism, and as you've heard, for at least theoretical communism. He covers so much territory that it's frankly hard to keep up on many instances, because he has opinions on everything from contemporary film to, as we've heard, Hugo Chavez and Aristide and Lenin and Obama. We're talking with him about a wide range of his interests, and we're going to go to our callers here. In fact, this is a man who's been called an intellectual rock star and who has taught at Princeton and at Columbia, as well as at the New School, but has a permanent appointment in Slovenia, which is his home country. Let's go to Scott first, and Scott, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
Thanks for the call. I'm really appreciating the essence of the discussion, and I had a question, if you can hear me. He didn't quite finish ending the question of whether or not communism was the end-all, and then conversely, whether or not he sees capitalism as essentially a greed mechanism of, you know, one person surviving over another. That was my main question.
Okay. Well, I guess it all goes back to Hegel and the dialectic, doesn't it, Mr. Zizek? If you see communism as the end-all, it's a synthesis of feudalism and capitalism, isn't it?
No, it's much more complex. Let me just briefly state so that we don't lose time my main point. Again, when I talked to Fukuyama, what I claimed is basically in the same way that when I was young, all leftists were dreaming of a socialism with a human face. Today, it is as if the most the left can imagine is, let me call it ironically, capitalism with a human face. You know, it's a little bit like, if I may be vicious, like John Kerry was for me, that's why he failed, Bush with a human face. Okay, my point is this enough, or, to use these bombastic old-fashioned terms, are there antagonisms, problems, which in the long term cannot be solved or even properly addressed within this liberal democratic capitalist frame? I think there is quite a series of such problems. First, and okay, we don't have time, but we can go through any of them. First, ecology. Then, the problem of intellectual property, I think in the long term, intellectual property cannot be squeezed into the framework of private property. Third point, biogenetics. You cannot allow capitalist logic to operate freely there. And last feature, the what I call disintegration of public life, new forms of apartheid, of exclusions.
Wait, let me move you back. Why can't you let capitalism operate in biogenetics? What's the danger or the peril?
Because we are dealing with, let's put it in this way, our shared what does biogenetic touch upon? It's our shared legacy of our genes and so on and so on. And I claim that the risks are so high here that if you allow the logic of private property to operate freely or even basically with a limited state control, the risks are too high. My God, we are playing with something which redefines our human nature. Even in his latest book, Fukuyama himself on our post-human future or whatever, he there admits that singularly just this problem of what is going on today in cognitive sciences, biogenetics, and so on, is affecting human nature so deeply that he himself admits that it invalidates his old thesis of the end of history. Just to give you one idea, then we can move on. Where do I see these limits? For example, are we aware that with the latest achievements at this level, the very most elementary distinction between inner life and outside life is disappearing? We all know that it's already possible, still at a very primitive level, but the perspective is here, to directly connect our brain processes with a computer and so on, so that we can, since computer can decode directly our thoughts, if you want to put it this way, our brain process, so that we can move objects, we can interact with outer world directly by our thoughts. You think about something...
Telekinesis you're talking about?
Yeah, but no, I'm not the telekinesis. I'm talking about purely materialist processes of wiring our brain directly to a computer, and in this way you can move objects. No telekinesis. It's done purely scientifically. Like, you can already play video games, move objects just by thinking about it, because your brain is directly wired onto a computer, which is then connected. Are we aware that in this way, what is a human being is redefined? Our very sense of what does it mean, privacy, personal autonomy, and so on and so on. All I'm saying is that radical things are happening here, things which effectively change what was understood till now as being a human being.
And let me bring in more of our callers here. And Sarah, you're next. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering what the guest thinks about the Disney movies and what the kind of portends for the youth of today. They're really violent, and yet they're marketed pretty innocently toward kids who are in the maybe 3 to 8 year old range, the Disney cartoons.
That's a nice question, but I must say here that with all my criticism of Disney, I don't locate their danger principally in violence. Like, let me tell you a shocking detail. I have a son of 7 years. I totally support and allow him to play Grand Theft Auto and games like that. I don't believe in this simple causality of you see violent things, you see violent thing on the screen, you will do them.
What about, you play those ultra-violent military computer games, I know. What about those for your 7-year-old? Are those okay?
They're too complex for him. That's the only reason he doesn't play them.
Otherwise, it would be okay, yeah.
No. Wait a minute. You know, what I try to avoid is this simplistic logic that in reality, you do something that you dream about. No, behind what I'm saying now is a very precise psychoanalytic reasoning. I think that we, by principle, fantasies doesn't work this way that you dream about in order to do it in reality. Mostly we dream about things, inclusive sex, often I claim, so that you don't have to do it in reality, which is why a very common experience. If you are honest, you would have to admit that often the worst thing that can happen to you is that in reality you are forced to assume, to enact what you dream about.
You've prompted me to quote Edward Albee, the American playwright, who said, when you're younger, you use pornographic playing cards to substitute for the real thing, and then when you're older, you use the real thing to substitute for the fantasies of pornographic playing cards.
I absolutely agree with it. I think this is a deeply Freudian remark, in authentic Freudian sense, where, you know, just where do we need fantasy? Again, as he said, just imagine when you are naked with your partner or partners, whatever. What do you do there? You enact your fantasies, but always in a deficient way and so on and so on. So again, the relationship here is very complex, which is why, now to go to the end and make a problematic remark, but with which I convinced many feminists even. I simplify to the utmost. Let's take two type of women, two ideal types. One, autonomous, assertive and so on. The other, passive, daydreaming, having masochist fantasies. I claim that if they are both, God forbid, I'm totally against rape, I'm ready to defend death penalty here, but if they are both raped, I claim that the second one, the passive masochist one, would have been shattered much more, precisely because the external event, the brutal rape, touched her inner fantasies. So you see where I hope I'm a radical feminist. For me, then the usual male chauvinist excuse, basically she got what she wanted. If this is true, it's even worse. This is the true psychic catastrophe of rape. Not that it was degrading because something was forcefully, violently imposed on you, but precisely because what was imposed from you in a way stirred up, touched your innermost fantasies. This is the most horrible thing that can happen.
Let me get more callers on for you. And Yassan, good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi.
All right. I wanted to ask the speaker about what his thoughts are on the Burning Man experiment.
You know about Burning Man, Professor Zizek?
Unfortunately not.
No?
The gift economy.
Well, it's a phenomenon in California that has brought people literally from all over the world, where they go through a ritual of burning an effigy, a very big one at that.
Well, it's more about a new type of society.
Well, but it's also a collective society, right? They have their own police force. They have their own form of exchange commercially. And it's all about art, really, as well, isn't it?
Gift economy.
Yeah.
When you say burning art...
all kinds of art. People come and they put up statues and they put up sort of ready-to-made kind of art and express themselves in so many different ways. It's a kind of utopian bohemian life, really, for at least a couple of
years. I'm deeply distrustful on it. Okay, I know many other phenomena which are recent half-cultural phenomena, like I write in my book about masturbaton and all those horrors. But about this, all I can say is that This phenomenon, if I understood you correctly, confirms my basic old-fashioned Marxist, maybe not so old-fashioned thesis, that today's capitalism is effectively a cultural capitalism, not only in the sense that that many products sold concern somehow culture, but in a more radical sense that the way you as a consumer are addressed, how are you addressed by publicity and so on. It's no longer as in the old 19th century capitalism where the idea was buy this product because it has certain qualities which satisfy your needs. Then we went with more consumerist capitalism into next level where competition comes. Buy this car so that, you know, keep up with the Joneses, envy and so on. But I think today we are at a new level where capitalism talks more and more in the term of self-realization, like buy this apple, not because it's simply good as an organic product, not because your neighbors have it and you should keep up with the fashion, but because it allows you to realize your true self, you contribute to the welfare and so on and so on.
Because in some instances it's grown ecologically correct and you can feel good about its environmental political correctness, right? Isn't that often a part of the whole sales these days? I think we've lost our guest. I don't hear Slavoj Žižek. Yeah, we're going to go on to some more callers here. Yeah, let me go to the next caller, and that's you, Lawrence. Good morning, Lawrence.
I wanted to say, Joe, I would hope that he could hear me.
Yeah, we're getting him back on the line.
Okay, good. That most of the world believes in a conflict between capitalism and socialism, or a dualism between capitalism and socialism or communism. And what they mean by socialism is state control versus corporate control of capitalism. But that's actually a false opposition because there's a third alternative. I wouldn't say it's in the middle, it's entirely different, which is dealing with democratic cooperatives, decentralized democratic cooperatives. And that's why Hugo Chavez is so interesting in Venezuela, because there's a huge upswelling of independent democratic workers' co-ops, and the idea of local communal councils, which are smaller than cities, which, you know, maybe a couple of thousand people that control industries. And this is something that is entirely different from state socialism or state communism.
Wait, let me make sure we have you back on the line, Slavoj Žižek.
Yeah, I hear everything.
Oh, good.
Everything
okay.
Okay, so what's interesting right now about Venezuela is that all three of these conditions of you have state-controlled industry, you have capitalist industry, and you have democratic cooperatives, and it's not certain which one of these is going to eventually dominate. But if we're really going to have a democratic world, it's going to be neither capitalism nor socialism and communism, but decentralized democratic cooperatives in a society that is dominated by that.
Well, let me go to our guest.
Nice question, but you know where I am? I'm here a little bit more skeptic, although people usually accuse me of being utopian. If there is a lesson from Chavez, is that in order for this democratic, low-level, self-organizing cooperative to have a space to thrive, you need a very strong state to create it. I mean, let's not forget that Chavez is not only this grassroots democratic cooperatives, but it's a very strong state. Mm-hmm. He grabbed power. Ironically, and this is not even for me to condemn Chavez, I almost ironically admire it. You know what's the usual story of a politician? You try democratically, it doesn't get it. If you are in a certain country where it can be done, you do a military coup d'etat. Remember that Chavez did the same in the opposite direction. He tried first, some 15 years ago, I think, a coup d'etat. It failed, so as a second best, my God, why not a democracy? But what I'm saying is that I like the starting point of the question, that the opposition is capitalism, socialism, because nobody seems to believe today the third way, socialism vanished. What we are talking today usually is capitalism as liberal capitalism versus new forms of fundamentalism, religious, and so on and so on. So I would just change the coordinates in a way. I totally agree with what it was said about state socialism and so on and so on. That utterly failed. I agree. But the problem I see where I'm more of a realist is, again, a following one. Can the model of local cooperatives and so on, the way we know it, can it really be universalized? Can it really, even in the long-term perspective, utopian slightly, does it have the way we see it today, does it have the potential to universalize itself, to take all the functions? Or do we still need something like state? I am a little bit skeptical here. On the second hand, what I like in your question is this emphasis on state. In what sense? In the sense that, you know, when you said manager companies, corporations versus state, it's not even versus. Look what's going on. That's for me the ultimate irony. Today, in the last two decades from Reagan onwards in United States, the official Republican ideology is get rid of Washington, let state, and so on and so on. But as many grassroots, even right-wing liberal Republicans are admitting, if anything, the last Bush administration stands for an extreme explosive growth of state apparatus. My God, new functions, but it's stronger than ever.
Well, the ideal of Marx is, of course, for the state eventually to disappear. But I'm struck by something. You called yourself, or you said you've been accused more of being a utopianist than of being a skeptic. And here,
I try to be extremely sarcastic realist also.
Well, I'm wondering if this was another statement of yours that you may have been trying to be ironic.
Which one?
You were talking about teaching, and you said students are mostly stupid and boring, as are most people. That's at least the quote that I saw. That would not suggest a utopianist. That would suggest, maybe a misanthrope or a real downright cynic.
I am a misanthrope. What has to do this with utopia? Wait a minute. That's another...
Well, because if you believe in utopia, you believe in the potential for people to bring utopia about or to make utopia happen.
No. I am, and some friends of mine call me that. I am a kind of, how should I call it? Leftist whose basic view of nature is that people are corrupt and evil. I'm a Protestant leftist. And I think that the most dangerous regimes were always those true dangerous totalitarianisms which believed in good human nature. Sorry to tell you, but Stalinism believed in good human nature.
Well, now here's an email, right, dovetailing with that from a listener who says, if I understood him, meaning you, correctly, your guest said that the world still has yet to understand the catastrophe of Stalinism. Is he familiar with the thesis of R.J. Rummel, nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, in his book Power to Kill and Death by Government, which basically states that extreme concentration of governmental power was responsible for more deaths in the last century than international conflict, approximately 130 million?
Yes, I know that thesis, but again, it doesn't explain the fundamental mystery. I know these are the easy answers and so on and so on. But what it doesn't explain is, for example, this is what I mean by mystery of Stalinism. It wasn't simply, just to give you some hints, one obvious fact, it wasn't simply that the state exerted unlimited control and terrorizing the broad population to retain its power. The most under the true high Stalinism, late 30s, from the true high-level Stalinism was from 34 till 38. The most dangerous place to be was top nomenclatura itself. Look at the statistic. From 35 till 37, 75% of Central Committee members, 80% of Army headquarters, 85% of Komsomol, Politburo, whatever, I mean, Central Committee, were liquidated. It was literally the ruling class starting to eat itself, in a way. It was a much more crazy phenomenon. You cannot explain it in these simplistic Orwellian terms of, you know, guys up there who have total control and what to retaining by terrorizing ordinary people. If anything, they were more terrorizing themselves. So the questions are much more complex. I mean, but I'm not an idiot here. My God, I know all the main theories, of course, of Stalinism, of totalitarianism, from Hannah Arendt to the standard historical perspectives of Robert Conquest to this, then up to these so-called revisionists, which are, I think, the best. Oleg Naumov, Paul Getty, Sheila Fitzpatrick, and so on and so on. Only they, this new generation, I think, are slowly approaching the mystery of Stalinism.
Let me go to a number of questions here that listeners are sending it to us by email. Actually, one is This is kind of on a lighter, well, maybe not so much a lighter note. A listener named Marin says, I had a different interpretation from Mr. Zizek on Kung Fu Panda. He said it was deeply cynical and told us to believe in things despite there being no substance to them. However, I feel that the point of the film was to realize that it is more important to believe in the power of the self and realize that you're not going to find your full potential by looking to outside organizations or dogma. Here's Stephanie, who says, so what about desensitization that occurs when one is steeped in violent images? Isn't that the point of military training games?
Here, think again. We would have to go into details here. First, the second question. Here, things, I think, are much more mysterious and ambiguous. First, I think that military violence plays a double game. I mean, also military propaganda and so on. On the one hand, it is de-aesthetization. On the other hand, it's also an answer, a kind of a re-sensitivitation, an answer to this general idea to which there is some truth that on average we live a relatively comfortable life, protected of shocks, of shocking encounters and so on and so on. This general idea that we live in a society of appearances, of fakes and so on. So what the military life promises is a kind of a false, fake, but nonetheless actual reconnection with blood, passion, with real life, and so on and so on. So I think it's more paradoxical. As to that point about Kung Fu Panda, but that the point about no substance, that is to say, as they put it in the movie, no special ingredient, trust self. Again, I don't think if you look at it closely, this is the image. This is the message of the film. The message is rather trust yourself and then fate will realize yourself. It's not, if you abolish all this, it's not just faith into self.
I'm not sure how many people have actually even seen the movie, so I'm going to go into another email here, and this is from Peter in Oakland, who says, I have a question that follows up on the issue of capitalism and genetic engineering. Mm. Just as in natural systems, different species compete for power, and some secure greater power over others, while others decline, isn't the commodification of our genetic heritage the next inevitable step in the evolution of how power is mediated within our society? The fact that this threatens human nature doesn't make it impossible, it makes it inevitable. The deeper question is this: isn't capitalism's inevitability tied to the fact that it mirrors natural systems and the way in which power is mediated within those systems?
It's a very nice question. What my counter proposal would have been, and here I learned the lesson of relatively progressive Darwinists like Stephen Jay Gould and so on and so on, is that when we describe something as natural state, what goes on in nature, we should be much more careful. For example, people usually totally misread Darwin's notion of survival of the fittest. It doesn't mean the best win. It means that nature is, it means basically, and that would be my paradoxical definition of a truly progressive ecology. The first statement is there is no nature in the sense of stable homeostatic system. Nature is crazy. Everything is fragile. Something explodes, the other thing loses. It has nothing to do with qualities. It's just opportunistic tinkering and so on and so on. So that's the first thing. We should radically change this negative theological, pseudo-ideological ecology, which describes nature as some kind of a balanced system, and then we humans screwed it up, our hubris, and now we have to pay the price back to Mother Earth. Wait a minute. What's our main source of energy? Oil. Are we even ready to imagine what kind of a mega ecological catastrophe had to happen on Earth so that we have oil? I mean, nature is crazy. Nature is its own greatest destroyer and enemy.
Let me get David in here, who's been waiting patiently to talk with you. David,
sorry,
go ahead.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Hi, David here from Berkeley. I wonder if you could comment on the European social democracies and their response to globalization.
It's a good, tragic question, because here, my God, even at the price of sounding almost as neoconservative, I claim that effectively and unfortunately their basic reaction is either opportunistic third way left, which basically means as Peter Mandelson, one of the second, third persons behind Tony Blair, openly said, let's face it, in economy we are all Thatcherites. It's just a question of, again, more justice, cultural rights, and so on. Or they are old welfare state nostalgics. They do not have... The tragic fact is that today's left doesn't have a truly feasible alternative. So I'm saying this as a leftist, my God, that we have to face this. Let's not behave from a position of moral superiority as if, you know, we have the right answers, just we have to mobilize people and so on and so on. No, we don't have the right answers. Nobody has them, maybe.
Maybe we'll try for another question while we have just about a minute. Bill, yeah. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, this is Bill.
Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Yes, hi. I wanted to question your definition of fascism as crazy guys who do crazy things. My understanding is that that fascism grows out of capitalism in crisis, and that it's a systematic outgrowth of capitalism. You look at Germany and you see all the corporations, Siemens, Mercedes, and all surviving through capitalism. So,
well, we got less than a minute left, Bill, so we'll try to
get this. Very briefly, I reply. No, we totally agree here. Sorry, first, if I remember correctly, I didn't say crazy, I said evil. I agree with you, my God, I'm here an old-fashioned Marxist. Of course, fascism, the whole problem of fascism is that it is the outgrowth of the inner crisis of capitalism and so on. All I wanted to say is that in contrast to communism, fascism, in a way, did what it promised. You can play. This is why in fascism, typically, you don't have dissidents. You don't have those who... Nobody confronted Hitler claiming you betrayed our Nazi ideals. He didn't betray them.
You can meet Slavoj Žižek tomorrow night at City Arts. He'll be there. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to me also.
Pleasure to have had you. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Hours repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell and Nick Vadinsky. And our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. Thank you for listening. We do appreciate your listenership. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.